Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Bodhisattva Vow by the Beastie Boys. Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys, born today in 1964. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Welcome, I'm Mark Steiner, and we are here today at the Common Ground on the Hill. We've been doing shows with them for, 10 years or more. every time they have a festival, which has been the last 16 years now,
yeah.
We've been with Walt Michaels doing that, and we are here taping today at Common Ground on the Hill. Walt Michaels is with us, of course, who is the founder and director, director
yep.
of Common Ground on the Hill. And we have three folks here with us in their studios who are all involved with mountaintop removal and the survival of Appalachia. We have Derek Minius with us, who is an activist from Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, Art Minius.
Art, what did I call you?
Derek.
So I always transpose names like that. And sorry about that. And we have Derek Mullins. I have that one right.
That's correct.
Who's chairman of Apple Shop. And we'll talk about that in a bit. And into the studio with a painting walked Ellen Elms, who lives in June Ridge, Virginia, where she's a teacher and activist, and painted this gorgeous picture of mountaintop removal. And we'll talk about that. And good to have you all here.
Or actually, good to be here. Yeah.
And so, Walt, let me ask you this question. I want you to start off and reintroduce these three people very quickly.
Okay.
So I gave the introduction, but, you know, they're very modest people. So you said that's the introduction they might have given, but this is the real introduction.
Well, these are all people who are here doing their art and music, etc., and they also happen to be activists. Ellen Elms is a graduate of Western Maryland College, also known as McDaniel College, and we actually worked together in McDowell County years ago in the 1960s. Doing student service work. And Ellen and her husband Don returned to the mountains very soon thereafter and built their lives there in southern Appalachia, McDowell County, and now over into Richlands, Virginia. And Ellen has been an art teacher all those years, teaching not only at Southwest Virginia Community College, but also in community, where she's oftentimes working with young people telling the story through murals of their homes, of their towns, and in that way getting the kids to understand more about where they are in time and place, and to embrace and perhaps learn history that they may not have known. She's really good at getting communities to look at themselves by way of getting their stories and taking their stories and then putting it into mural form. She also does a lot of other great painting and artwork.
And the gentleman to my right and left?
To your right?
Derek Mullins.
Derek Mullins from Apple Shop in Kentucky. Apple Shop, he can tell you more about Apple Shop, but it is a film and music resource center for the folks in the mountains. It's very active in getting the word out about mountaintop removal and all kinds of other issues relative to life in the mountains. And Derek is here teaching a class called Apple Shop, where he's showing films and getting us flatlanders a little more savvy about what's going on in the mountains and how it relates to us. Art Menius is from North Carolina, now living in Kentucky, and he is an arts person from the get-go. He has helped build various organizations such as the Folk Alliance, the International Bluegrass Music Association, Mural Fest, which is Doc Watson's great festival in North Carolina, and was with Apple Shop for a number of years. And Art is here visiting us for the first time, and we're exploring possibilities that maybe bring us together in a work format. Art is also a great music historian.
I think what's interesting is that what you do here at Common Ground on the Hill is the idea of bringing people who are activists as well as artists together in one place. And there is a synergy. between what you bring in terms of the artists from the South who come out of the blues tradition and the singers from Appalachia who come out of their tradition. And these are really also the roots of American struggle, the same place they're the roots of our music, which I find That's an right. interesting marriage here. Which one of these, I love this thing. I love watching you grow over the years. And Derek, let me just ask Starks. You were, before we started the conversation, mm-hmm. you were talking about your own life with your dad. You said, my dad's a miner. Matter of fact, as we speak, he's probably in the mine now.
Yeah, he most certainly is. Like, it's really interesting. Like, the way I try to explain it to people is, you know, like, there's certain things that, like, so for example, there's no point that I can't remember, like, not knowing what a tree was. You know, like, you learn so many things, like, at such a, you know, like, it's like you've just always known what a tree was. Like, you see a tree and you're like, that's a tree. And it's like, you know, just this, like, common experience that we all have that you just learn so many things, like, at such a young age that it just seems like you've always known what a tree is. And, like, one day, like, it really dawned on me this idea that, like, I've always known what coal is. Like, there's never a point in my life that I've not known what coal was. And then I started thinking, okay, well, actually, that's sort of weird because there's a lot of people who, like, you know, like, they don't know what coal is until, like, you know, they learn about it in, like, school or, like, a geology class or for, like, whatever reason. And so, I mean, like, that's kind of, I think that's a real testament to kind of, like, the life that is in, like, Eastern Kentucky when you live in the coal fields. You know, it's like my father's always been a miner. I've always known, like, what... coal was and dealt with mm-hmm. it on a day-to-day basis. You know, I mean, like, having a family member like that, I would imagine it to be very similar to, like, a police officer or a firefighter. And, you know, I mean, it, like, it's just something that's always in the back of your mind. You know, like, they keep really long hours. It's interesting because I just, like, see it so much as a psychological problem too. Like, I don't, you know,
being a miner.
Miners' family, the communities, mm-hmm. like, you know, I mean, like, we talk about coal in the environmental way, like, we talk about coal, you know, like, it's, like, what gets really dangerous is when you just, like, see it from just, like, one place, because it's so large, and I, you know, like, so, like, on the psychological end, you know, they keep long hours, and, like, you know, growing up, it's like a coal miner's son, it's like, of course, my dad always comes home late, works 2 hours longer than he's supposed to. And I've been dealing with him doing that for, you know, 31 years. But, like, every time it happens, you just can't, like, shake this thought that it's like, please, please don't let anything be wrong. Like, you know, like, where is he? You know, and it, like, really just dominates so much of your life. I mean, so it's really different on the ground. And that's why, you know, you can't it's like I was talking to my friend Dan Collins last night. I was like... I don't see how anyone in good conscience could just sit there and see what's happening and at least not try to learn and, like, talk to people in the community and, like, try to figure out something.
Yeah, I want to get to this point. And feel free as this conversation kind of erupts with it. And I don't have to this point to you about it. But Art, I want to kind of also ask you a little bit about your involvement in this, because you both have an apple shop, which we'll talk about in a minute, but... You're from North Carolina originally.
Yes, I'm from North Carolina, and so I see the issues with coal through a couple of lenses that fit my background. One, I grew up with the tobacco industry. You know, instead of providing electricity for folks and have that as our economy, we provided addictive carcinogen. So we took the high road in North Carolina. and that industry...
I used to love that stick myself for a long time.
Yeah, me too.
And that industry has greatly changed and no longer is the driver of the economy of Eastern North Carolina. And then from the Piedmont, since I literally lived where the Piedmont met the coastal plain, you had the cotton mills, which as far as the workers' families and the lifestyle of where you could be turned out of your house or would be if you lost your job, you were out of your house where you're dependent on company script rather than cash money, dependent on the company store, too far in hock to just up and quit. But there's one big difference there. And Derek just alluded to that big difference. Yeah, there are occasionally cotton mill fires. There are accidents in the cotton mill. The lungs of the workers would be destroyed over time from the dust. But cotton mill workers' families very rarely had the thought of, I hope daddy and brother come home safe tonight. You'd work long hours just like Derek's dad, but you didn't have that specter hovering over mm-hmm. you of one wrong step and he's dead.
I mean, because coal is a way of life. It insinuates itself in every pore of your being when you're there living and working in it, and you don't do that in cotton, nor do you do that in tobacco.
There's a song that talks about a child asking, Daddy, please don't go to the mines today. I've had an awful dream.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a powerful song. Stanley, it's about a child having this pre-recognition that a tragedy is about to befall. And I think that's probably what Derek, was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this West Virginia disaster that just happened. You know, as soon as news came to me, the first thing I did was, like, call my mom to see if my dad made it home from a shift. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, that's kind of like, I mean, anytime anything like that happens for me, the first thing I do is I call to make sure my dad's made it home from his shift. And then generally the second thing I do is I go through my house and I turn off every light in the house so that way, like, it's at least some type of acknowledgement that somebody just got killed because, you know, like, we like electricity.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, a good part of it is, you know, this idea that, you know, like, one thing that I really stress when I'm here in the image that I try to give people is, for me, you know, every light switch I turn on, it's real easy for me to see my dad in my mind. And when I do flip light switches on, that's what I see. And it really makes you start using power a lot different when you know there's a man behind it. And especially your own father, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, one thing I really try to do here, you know, and, like, someone came up to me after the first year that I was here, and they were like, well, you know, I went back to Florida, and of course I couldn't visualize your dad's face when I would flip on a light switch, but I visualized yours. And I just want to thank you because I have a really, really cheap power bill now.
So what is it about – were you about to say something?
I was going to – go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is it – I want to come back to what we were just saying because I think it's very powerful. I want to kind of explore it in some depth. But where's the line between coal mining and mountaintop removal for you all? I mean, that's
Yeah, mountaintop removal is just a small subset of total coal mining. Western Kentucky, Southern Illinois, they're mining coal deep without using mountaintop removal mining techniques. You can end mountaintop removal mining without ending coal mining. And there are a couple of important factors there. One is that deep mining and even traditional surface mining employ a lot more people than MTR. The background
MTR to being mountaintop removal, as we use the term,
I think the background there is the coal in central Appalachia, as well as up in parts of Pennsylvania, is the best. It is the top dollar coal. Coal is 50% of our power supply because it's the cheapest way to run traditional power plants. Since the Appalachian coal is the best and most expensive, it has to compete on price point with the cheaper coal from out west, especially out in the western states. Therefore, MTR is an intentional effort to keep the price of Appalachian coal as low as possible, but it's still not at all the majority of coal mining. A spokesman from Consol Energy, and I would be very surprised if this gentleman still has his job, which would be sort of a shame because he was frank and honest with the Wall Street Journal last year. He said, and Consol's based in Pittsburgh, he said, well, if MTR were made illegal, there'd be an immediate cut of 7-8% in our production. As far as our revenues are concerned, the higher prices that would result would immediately balance out the loss of that production.
that says a great deal.
Where when you talk about loss, though, then with mountaintop removal, you've got the permanent loss of the whole mountaintop and all that goes with it, which, you know, here you're saying the company can replace, they can make up for it.
And the impending doom of the coal slurries that live up above the people and that will at some point release.
Right.
Well, you know, and it's really hard to, like, I mean, like, the reality of it is, it's like before we were talking, you know, like of the three, like if you look at it, oil, natural gas, and coal, coal is always the cheapest. But that word, like the cheapest, is kind of hard to swallow, right, when you're in the middle of it. Like, you know, people in Baltimore, like I'm sure they complain when they get their power bill and they've been running their air conditioning all summer because it's really hot. And, you know, power bills can get out of hand real quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like you open up your mail and there's the power bill and it's like $90 power bill. And you're like real upset and everything. And like the way that I look at it is that like they're getting out real, real cheap compared to, you know, like what we're paying. And like the funny part of it is that it's just like, I really wish that you could put like, you know, like have you ever, you know, you look at a power bill and it measures out the kilowatts and all that. Like it would be really good to have like death tolls, like landmines. Like if you
real
know,
like
if they could be real honest real and just
cost.
Like kind of like factor that in when you get your power bill and you can see how many coal miners have died and you can see how much land's been lost. You can see how many streams have been lost. Like, you know, I mean, like you look at your power bill and like, so to me, it's like, and he's right, you know, it's like, it's the cheapest. It's always the cheapest, but it's like that. There's just something about like referring to it that way. Like when you really understand like the cost of that, like, the communities in which, you know, these resources are like gathered, like the cost that they pay, like then all of a sudden, like to me, coal becomes very, very expensive.
We never factor those kind of things into. That's not the way we think about money. That's not the way we think about. We don't think about product that way. We think about product as money, not about lives, not about communities, not about the environment that gets destroyed around it.
Derek, in the class the other day. Search for Common Ground class where Derek presented, he talked about where the conversation is about this. It's, you know, it comes from all kinds of places, those pro, those con, but what Derek, I believe, was saying was that nobody really asks the people in community what they think. They don't ask the coal miners, what is the solution to this?
Yeah, of course not. Well, I mean, you know, there's just like too much of a vested interest for people, and like they kind of just get to a point to where, I don't know. I mean, like I feel like that not only just around like coal mining, but like all the other issues that's like going on in this day and age. You know, immigration, like the stuff out there in Arizona. Like, I mean, you can just go on down the line, like. You know, like I started out by being like, well, we're running this real threat. But the reality is, as it's happening, is that, like, you know, we're in this period where we really need to start answering questions. And, like, they're not inviting anybody to the table. So, like, when you talk about...
Who's they that's not inviting people to the table?
The federal government, corporations, you know, I mean, like... So we're, you know, we're reaching this period. So, for example, there's this, like, kind of discussion going on around energy policy. Or like even let's even step back one step further and say that so there's a discussion, there's dialogue going on about mountaintop removal. So in that sense, then you have people like the Kentucky Coal Association, the West Virginia Coal Association, Faces of Coal, all these people who they have their PR and their slogans and they're really pushing that coal is the best thing. And they have these really funny stickers that are like coal mining our future. And of course, you know, it's supposed to be coal mining our future, but like I always just like to speed it up and be like, yeah, coal mining our future.
Our future?
Yeah. So, you know, there's those people. And then on the other end, there's kind of like, of course, you know, people who are really trying to figure it out and stop coal. And, but oftentimes what ends up happening is that these two opposite sides, they get together and they start screaming their rhetoric at each other. And in the meantime, no one is asking people like my father or the people who are on the ground to be involved in that conversation, which is a real mistake, in my opinion, because as we move forward with solutions, like you have to have the investment of the community. And like in some ways, the way I described it in the class was, is it's like mom and dad are arguing in the room about what's best for us. And we're supposed to just be quiet until they figure it out. which is just a real, you know, it's a real mistake. Like, I mean, anytime there's any coal issue, the first person I talk to about it's my dad, you know, because he's a coal miner.
Let's talk. I'm going to push that. Were you about to say something? Let's push that a minute, though. I mean, I'm really interested in that because you come from a coal mining family. You right. all live in
coal field
communities, three of y'all. And you watch how, politically speaking, in a Democrat or Republican sense, the people who get elected from your regions are always pro-coal. They're never fighting mountaintop removal. I mean, that's what they do in Congress. I mean, whether it's West Virginia or Southwest Virginia or Kentucky or Southwest Pennsylvania, it's those folks get elected. So I'm curious what you think. So that's always the bellwether in America. Who gets elected is who has the pulse and will of the people behind them. I mean, that's right. That's the common sense and logic. But let's talk about what you're talking about. Let's talk about what's under that. I mean, what would people really say who lived in it? Because the miners I've met, let's say around my sister's place in West Virginia, they need mining to feed their families. Yeah. They don't want mining to end. They have to continue taking care of people. So let me start again and do very quickly. All of you just jump in here. But I mean, what would your dad say about that? What would your dad say about the mining? When you say you go to your dad first, what does dad say? And what are you all hearing?
Well, I mean, like the reality of it is that it's kind of like things are set up in a very unfair way to where you can't have very like open and public dialogue in Eastern Kentucky around this issue. I mean, like that's just the bottom line. So like, for example, the things that my dad says in private that in candid and like when he and I discuss the issues are like very different than like what he can say. I mean, like there's just this certain level of privilege that's denied to everyone. You know, it's like the other day I was talking, like it's people have a vested interest, like the companies, like state, local government, like they don't want dialogue to begin. So like they're trying to kill any type of discussion before like, you know, you can have it, because like the reality of it is that you get real dangerous when you come together as a community. And like, so all they're doing is they're like really splitting everybody up to get start out with. So for example, my dad goes to work and what my dad hears is, or any coal miners, tree huggers are trying to take your jobs. They're threatening your way of life. Like they're, you know, there's a potential that they're going to rob you of like being able to support your family. Okay. So all of a sudden a line's drawn. And then on the other, you know, so like right then and there, like it becomes very, very difficult to have any type of real conversation. And if you do, you know, everyone is so dependent on the industry down in there that you can't have like honest civil dialogue. Like, you know, like we, like what I was trying to, the point I was trying to make the other day is for one thing, we need to become very, very much more civil in this country. Like we need to learn how to talk to each other about things. You know, we have to learn how to, so for example, you know, the example I gave is like when I talk to my father and my uncles and my cousins that are in the mines, I talk about it in a very, very like from framing it in as economy. You know, because bottom line, everybody, you know, everybody's worried about the economy. So, like, if I went to my uncles and my cousins, you know, and I was like, well, actually, these are the, you know, some of the oldest forests on the planet. Like, you know, we're destroying
they
this.
Are.
All they're going to hear is, this is some of the oldest forests on the planet, brother. But, like, but when I go to them and I'm like, actually, you know, like, we need to talk economy. Like, what is it doing to our jobs? Like, what is it, you know? And then they listen and see. And, like, in some ways, again, it's all about privilege because I have access to those people in a way that other ones don't. But as far as, like, this kind of widespread discussion, and I think that both of these folks can chime in, too, it just gets killed before it can start.
Right. Yeah. I can give a good example about this over another issue, but how it develops, as where Derek is saying people don't have a voice. Many years ago, when we first moved down to the mountains, we were involved in a school where the parents had a one-room school up on Coon Branch Mountain. In fact, Appleshop did a film about it eventually. But what happened was the parents decided, along with the help of some community people and a Vista worker, that they would start their own school for that fall. And the parents would provide hot lunches and playground. They fixed up a playground. And my husband and I ended up teaching the school in protest to the way they were being underserved in the school that they had, which was a one-room school. And we taught, the parents' school was a one-room school, but it was devoid of services and devoid of any caring about what children would gain as an education. And so to make a long story short, as soon as this became public knowledge, where we went to newspapers and had interviews, it was in the media, it started coming out that parents were coming together in community to make sure their children got a good education by having, you know, the right facilities and the teaching and the materials and everything. Then during the night, people's tires would be slashed. We had our house shot into. The parents were threatened with fines, huge fines of truancy for their children after they'd been out of what was considered by the school board out of school for a month where they were being taught. And so the more that this comes into the public eye, that you are banding together, then, of course, we were called hippies and communists and everything. And it's to then the powers that be try to divide the community. And I think you mentioned one of the best points is that mountaintop removal is not really coal mining, as Derek's dad knows it. And they're, the powers that be are lumping it right in. You know, you're going to lose your jobs. And you pointed out about how there are much fewer jobs involved in the mining, in mountaintop removal mining, than underground mining. And even the union is siding with, they're supporting mountaintop removal. They're not. And so here's the worker underground who doesn't have any organized force to stand for him or her other than the community.
Yeah, and there's no conversation starter if the issue is framed as pro coal or anti-coal. That gets nowhere. We got to look at balancing the issues and somehow getting a dialogue that moves beyond, that recognizes basic facts. The biggest one being that coal's not going to be there forever. Whether you say it's 40 years or 200 years, it's a finite resource, and only a small percentage of that resource can actually be extracted. And then on the other hand, with the environmental impacts of burning coal, the burning our future concept, there's another reason that coal might be stopped altogether. This was done in most of the Western European countries, especially France and Germany, where there is simple public policy to provide new jobs for people who worked in the coal industry and stop using it, create new sources of electricity and quit using coal. But ultimately, it is an economic issue that cannot be solved until we in Central Appalachia, working ground up from our communities, say, Mr. Mullins, this is the new job we have for you that's going to pay just as well as you've been in the mines. And once you get used to it, we think you're going to enjoy doing it because your neighbors have figured out this new job, whether it's making solar panels or whatever that's in the energy industry, but in a more environmentally responsible part of the energy industry. We have new ways for these communities to sustain themselves and ways that the community members themselves endorse. We're not going to get anywhere. We can't just throw tens of thousands of people out of the house just like the mine companies would do when people would get fired from their mining job. We can't abandon communities in a big part of America that's been darn near abandoned for decades. We have to work together, and we can't ignore the interest of the coal companies either. They have purchased these mineral rights, and there are a lot of issues about how they acquired them, but they have to continue supplying electricity to households until, just like with the jobs, we develop better sources of electricity that do less damage to the environment. It's a big policy problem that can't be solved.
And the discussion just isn't happening. I mean, like, another way that I try to explain it to people is the way that they set it up to really kill any type of conversation before it can really begin is, it's like the slogan, support our troops, you know, and the way that people use that slogan to kind of be like, well, if you don't support the war, then that means that you don't support the troops, which is, of course, the furthest thing, like, from the truth. Like, you can support troops and not support war. Like, in my mind, it's kind of like, if you do support troops, then you don't like war. And it's the same way in with the coal industry. It's like either you're for it or, you know, if you're critical of the coal industry, like people, like they're like from their perspective, they want to spin it to where like it's if you're critical of the coal industry, then you're against the miners, which is, of course, the furthest thing from the truth. Like the reason why I am critical of the, you know, like I feel like patriotism and, you know, like patriotism to me is like being very, very critical of your government and wanting them to aspire to be the very best that it can. And like the way that I was raised is that like I'm critical of the coal industry because I want the very best for those people. You know, like I was raised to hate the industry. I was raised to like be critical of the industry. I mean, like, and I never really saw it as like biting the hand that feeds me or anything like that. I mean, the reason why I learn and the reason why I want to know is because like I care about the people in it. But they're really like kind of diverting it to where it's like if you're against the industry, then you're against the miners. And then it's like a personal attack almost. So like when you go in to try to sit down and talk to these people and be like, okay, let's talk about this, they've done headed us off. And it's really interesting to see how the coal industry just like really looked at grassroots organizing and was like, oh, hey, you know what? We can do that. Like, let's start some thinly veiled like campaigns like Faces of Coal and Friends of Coal. And let's start our own grassroots like organizing campaigns. And let's, you know, like let's take one out of their playbook and like throw it right back at them. And let me tell you, they're very, very effective.
They have a lot of money to do it with, too.
They have a lot of money to do it with, you know. And the other thing is that they can kind of dangle the carrot, like, over everybody's head. You know, when they have these public hearings, for example, which is happening a lot now. Like, they just actually announced that they're getting ready to do more hearings, specifically around mountaintop removal. It was curious to me because they're holding one of them in Texas. And I was like, that's weird. They're having a, you know, so it's like all over the country they're doing these meetings. You know, what they'll do is the coal companies, they'll say, all right, fellas, you all have the day off today, but we expect you to go to this hearing and be a presence there. And if you can't make it, let us know. Like when they had this, I think it was Office on Surface Mining or I can't remember what it was, but they had this thing over in Pikeville and they rented out buses. And so they just loaded all these miners onto buses, you know, like the boss is telling them, you got to go to this hearing, you got to be there, you know. So like you get to these things and you get this real skewed perception because all of a sudden it's like 9-1 pro coal, but they're stacking the deck, you know.
I wonder what it would take to get warm, to get Trumka to change his mind.
You know, the
interesting question to ask him one day.
Yeah. What we're talking about here is marginalized culture. When I go around, whenever I play music, I ask the audience, how many of you have heard about mountaintop removal? And generally, it's like 1 out of 20. They don't know the term. And I say, how about strip mining? And, oh, maybe 8 out of 10 or maybe 15 out of 20 will raise their hands. Oh, yeah, strip mining. I said, well, it's the same thing, except it's on steroids. And most people think that strip mining was fixed and went away. So, you know, this is something that's on the back burner for most people in this country. So it's really important that we're having this conversation. And I think one of the things that we should say is that as awful as the oil spill is in the Gulf, this problem is every bit
as bad.
It's like it's an oil spill every day.
Yeah, well, that's been going on for like, what, 2-3 months?
Yeah.
This has been going on for like, what, 30, 40?
And
40,
there are no, you know, skimmers.
Years of surface mining.
And you know what the reality of it is? It's legal. And as long as it's legal, they're going to do it. And, like, I mean, like, so, for example, like, what's happening in the Gulf right now, of course, it's, like, some, like, outrage, but, and it's illegal, like, and there's all this scrutiny. And then all of a sudden you have, like, this practice that's equally as destructive, and it's legal.
Mm-hmm. And the other big difference is the Gulf was a mistake. It was a monumental screw-up.
Yeah, this is
mountaintop removal is intentional. Those mountaintops aren't being knocked off by accident.
And the EPA just, I think, if I read right the other day, gave another permit for another mountain.
They're not, you know, like the reality of it is someone like, I was talking to a guy once and he was like, I offended him actually, you know. He was like, why don't you call the EPA? And I laughed in his face. Like these agencies that like are, you know, that we fund as citizens are not, you know, they're supposed to be our watchdogs, and they're not. They're guard dogs for industry.
Like I'm sorry, first you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, like it's just like they're guard dogs for industry. Like they're not interested. Like these agencies, like I just don't even believe in them anymore. Like there's these hearings and stuff, and I just feel like it's kind of like posturizing or like kind of. It's almost like you go into these hearings and you just like feel like they're just rigged, mm-hmm. and like they're just like they're like trying to like give this transparent like you know appearance of democracy. Oh, we're going to listen to you, but you just go into them and you're like, well, and then you know if they enforced the laws that were on the books, a lot of these projects wouldn't fly. But they don't. And then there's these real, I mean, it's a real, real complex thing, you know, like, and of course, like Army Corps of Engineers is involved and mm-hmm. like the way that they define streams and stuff. It's like, you know, again, it's just like it's a rigged, stacked process to where like they try to give this idea that like, oh, well, we're trying to deal with it. I mean, I don't know how you all feel, but
well, it's powerful what you're saying. I agree with every bit of it, but I want to bring it back around a little bit back to the arts because fortunately the arts are community and are a force that kind of can rise above the level of place and filter beyond or spread beyond. And I think like what Apple Shop has been doing over all these years and recently, a lot of writers and singers and filmmakers, of course, have come out with really wonderful, in-depth, shocking, moving, emotional, but factual presentations. And actually, it was Kathy Mateo, who's coming here to Common Ground this weekend, who influenced me greatly when I read a book that was put together of essays by Silas House, the writer from also Down in the Hills. And she wrote about the fact that as an artist, as a musician, she finally realized she was running into trying to have conversations with neighbors and friends and people thinking she was on the other side because it was like you were saying, Derek, like she was on the side. If she was against mountaintop removal, she was against coal mining right. or coal miners. And she realized that the way she could contribute would be to start writing songs and addressing it vocally. And that really inspired me. And recently I've been organizing a group of painters and poets to have an exhibition that I hope will travel. And I hope one place will be Apple Shop, West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia, of expressions. And it will be based on a theme called Thinking Like a Mountain, which regards an essay that Aldo Leopold wrote years ago. And Aldo Leopold said, you know, I can't say his exact words, but this whole discussion is if we treat our land like commodity, we will always destroy it and ravage it. If we treat it like community, we will respect and preserve it.
And that's so much why we're here at Common Ground on the Hill each July. The artists are the best spokespeople for ordinary folks, for people whose lives are affected by these kind of meta issues. The art can tell the stories, and this is what we do at Apple Shop. It's not is creating art to tell a story, and then the receivers of that story go out and do what needs to be done, rather than trying to say, okay, this is the issue, this is what you need to do about it. Instead, it's create awareness to speak for the oppressed. It gets all into that theater of the oppressed concept, but to be the voice, and then the people can hear the real stories through the eyes of the artist and take the appropriate action.
I think this is funny that you, it happens like this often. I think it's just a synergy in the world, because as you began to speak, Ellen Elms, I was in the back of my head going, okay, I'm going to start asking some questions about the arts in Appalachia and how this feeds into the struggle for a better world. And you raised it anyway, and art continued, which is good. I want to introduce you all to our listeners. We're broadcasting right now from taping right now at Common Ground on the Hill. We're in their studios, and you heard just heard the voice of Art Minius, who worked with Apple Shop, and he is an activist from Eastern Kentucky. We also heard the voice of Ellen Elms, who is an artist and a painter, and we'll talk about this painting sitting to my left that I'm just moving my water to the right so it wouldn't fall on the painting to my left, who lives down in Southwest Virginia, and Derek Mullins, who's the son of a coal miner and chair of the board of Apple Shop, and, of course, Walt Michaels, who is founder and director of Common Ground on the Hill, where we're talking from today, and we'll be doing a couple more of these over the course of this festival.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show Archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. On our way to break, Pretend We're Dead by L7, Jennifer Finch of L7, born this day in 1966.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Do You Really Want to Hurt Me by Culture Club. On this day in 1986, Michael Rudetsky of the Culture Club passed away in 1986.
What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy.
We're broadcasting right now from taping right now at Common Ground on the Hill. You heard the voice of Art Minius, who worked with Apple Shop, and he is an activist from Eastern Kentucky. We also heard the voice of Ellen Elms, who is an artist and a painter, and Derek Mullins, who is the son of a coal miner and chair of the board of Apple Shop, and, of course, Walt Michaels, who is founder and director of Common Ground on the Hill, where we're talking from today, and we'll be doing a couple more of these over the course of this festival. Let's talk about what we just... what brought up here. I think it's important.
At the arts?
The arts and the importance of the arts on this. And I also want to, at some point in this conversation, to also get you all to talk a lot about Apple Shop, to bring that into the midst of this, to let people know what that's about. But go ahead,
I'd like
Walt.
To talk about the concept of the artist in community. I believe that artists have experienced the broadest spectrum of human experience. And let me just give you an example. As a musician, I have played in the coal camps of West Virginia, and I've also played for coal companies. They had nothing to do with one another in terms of the gig and how I got the gigs. And it was actually more coal traders, not coal companies. And these were just guys that came to hear my music and liked it and said, hey, we have this annual gathering. Would you like to play? Well, hey, I'm a musician. Yeah, pay me. I'm going to go play. And it was very revealing to me that I was playing for these people, and I said, so where's the coal come from? Yada, yada. And I found out some of it was McDowell County, and I said, there's some wonderful people there, and their eyes just glazed over. They didn't know anything about the people there, and the people in West Virginia who mine the coal didn't know anything about these people, these traders. So musicians, artists have this ability to sort of to move sideways and experience this broader spectrum of human experience that the people in power and the people without power can't see. So consequently, we have this opportunity as artists to create these dialogues that perhaps shed light on issues from a lot of different angles. And if we can, in the midst of this, and this is the common ground piece, if we can, in the midst of this, discover artists who are perhaps from a different ethnic base, who have this same kind of a flashpoint where they go, oh, same thing happens in my community. Or, you know, that dance step that you just did is just like this clog dancing step that I do. And the dance step that they may have just identified was African dance. So all of a sudden we have these points of interconnection that are surprising. You know, when a white guy goes, oh, I didn't know the banjo was from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just all kinds of things like that, that give us an opportunity to talk about things and to realize we really aren't that disconnected one from the other. The question is, how can we get everybody in on that, on wanting to know about these things? And that's the job of the artist, is to go out and do that.
And I'm curious how I think you're absolutely right, Walt. And I think I'm curious how the three of you use that in your everyday work, which is what you do.
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting thing, whether it be like a painting or a song or a play or a film or radio, like ultimately, what's really, really interesting to me, especially, you know, like with Apple Shop's work, it's really what it is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so I come from a painting tells a story, a song tells a story, a story tells a story. I mean, you know, it's storytelling, and I come from a very, very, like, as you can probably tell, I come from a family full of talkers.
I could never tell that.
So, I mean, it's storytelling, and like, and so the stories that we tell, like, in some ways, like, what really, to me, that happens, that's really interesting, is, you know, like, it's this whole idea of, like, well, you know, you tell these stories to kind of, like, educate and inform people, but the way I always describe it to people is, it's like if something really, really interesting happens to you,
mm-hmm.
and you tell four of your friends, and then you're out to lunch with one friend, and you run into someone else, and he's like, oh, you have to hear this guy's story, and so you have to tell the story again, and then you're at a party, and they're like, oh, you have to tell this story to these people. Like, not only are we, like, doing this, I think, to, like, kind of inform other people, but, you know, when you from the first time you tell that story to, like, the 15th time, it transforms into something so much larger. Like, mm-hmm. you understand yourself more in the story. You understand much more details about it. Like, you know, you're, like, it just, like, really transforms into something different. And it's almost like, I know, at least with Apple Shop's work and, like, and a lot of, you know, like, storytelling, is that you do it to inform yourself and to learn yourself. And, like, you know, I mean, like, the thing to me about mountaintop removal that I struggle with is that I just can't wrap my head around this, how it could be possibly conceived that it's a good idea. And almost, like, every day for me, you know, and, like, earlier when we were talking about civil dialogue and, like, the ways in which we approach people, like, the way that I've really come at the issue is that, like, I'm just trying to understand why anyone would think it's a good idea. Like, I'm open to, like, when I sit down with people, it's a funny thing. You can never sit down with someone and the first words out of your mouth be, you're wrong and I'm right, and it go well. Like, you know.
Or go anywhere.
Right, so, like, where I'm kind of at is, it's like, I would love nothing better for someone to come in here and say something that made me understand why we did mountaintop removal, because then it would be worth it. But through all of my travels and through all the people I've talked with, I mean, jobs are great, don't get me wrong, and everybody needs them, but I've yet to hear one single argument that makes sense. And maybe it's out there. Like I said, I would love nothing better. Like, unfortunately, I don't think that I'm ever going to find an answer. But it's interesting to approach people in that way and to use art and storytelling to, like, kind of bring people along with you and to bring yourself along.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your question about how do we utilize the arts, as a muralist, and as Walt mentioned earlier, I do a lot of what I call community murals. And a good example of how the arts can work for community, I feel like I'm sort of a vessel or an instrument or a vehicle for the community in a mural project, because what we do for example, in Grundy, Virginia, they had a situation where this relates back to the mining. They have had severe flooding conditions over the last number of years, and it's not all acts of God and nature. It's because of all the terrible mine erosion, and the changing of the land is causing much more severe flooding. And so they decided to pretty much bulldoze their downtown, which was right along the river. And the idea was that it would be moved to a higher plateau and people could rebuild who had been store owners for years and years and generations and generations. And so the community came together on that idea, and there was state and federal funding, huge amounts of money, and the project began. And then it just happened one summer. And in the meantime, a sign went up that Walmart was coming to that plateau, and that possibly then former owners of these longtime shops wouldn't be able to rebuild in competition. And so that fall, before the town was destroyed, I met with, I put an ad, just articles in newspapers, inviting anyone who had been a longtime resident of Grundy to come and share their stories. And we met once a week for every 6 weeks, and I was just the recorder of their stories. And then we started filtering down what were the important themes and stories. Then I went to work with community college students of mine in a drawing and design class, and they took the themes and turned it into imagery in their drawings, and then we put together a design. And then that summer that the town was being bulldozed, we were painting this mural just outside of town, because there were no walls then, about that community. And it was such a healing thing. I mean, it was terrible to go into town and seeing it being done, but the people had, before that, before the destruction had been made, they had preserved their memories through this imagery, and why they were such a wonderful community, and hope to someday again have that place and time to be community. And so it's so rewarding for me to be part of that process. But I'm just a vehicle, and then they put their voice there, and then it's on a wall, and there's a dedication, and people read what they want out of that story that connects to their story.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you,
Mark, coming to your house to talk today.
Yeah, like they say, you all come.
Yeah. Well, and also to throw the plug, so it's like appleshop.org, and it's like appleshop.org. I think the other plug I would give is like just to urge like the citizens of, your listening audience, to understand that they are very much like implicated in these issues. And like I said, I really wish that they could open up their power bill and see how many people have died and see how much money we've lost. And so like if I can think, how earlier I was telling you I've always known about coal, if I can think about it for every day for 31 years, then I think it's fair to ask of the listening audience for them to think about it for at least an hour,
Amen.
Or even just take a couple of minutes to go to ilovemountains.org, type in their zip code. If you're in the Baltimore area, you'll see you're getting your electricity from Mountaintop Removal Coal from Southeast West Virginia along I-77.
Yeah.
Mark Steiner here from Common Ground on the Hill. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And on our way out of here, it's Teen Town by Weather Report, Erto Marrera of the Weather Report, born on this day in 1941. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.